Oh, hey, welcome everybody to the Block Bites Daily Show. I didn't even know we were starting. All right, we got to start a GoFundMe so I can get a new mic. I don't know what is happening here. Twice in 30 seconds, it's gone out. But welcome to Block Bites, everybody here. It's me, Corval. First show of the new year, I believe. I was a little under the weather. But we're back, baby. We're back in a big way, and we've got Nick Drake on here. We're going to start off the year right by taking a macro look at what's going to happen. How do we feel about the markets? Where do we think the economy's going? So, guys, stick around. It's going to be a great show, and you might just learn something. Emmett, take me in.
They take your money, then they take you down with them. Let's do better together. ERN, extremely resilient, naturally.
How you doing, Mr. Drakon?
Hey, Corbel. I'm great, mate. How are you?
Dude, I was better before I had the mic failure twice at the start of the show, man. It was painful.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to get a new mic.
Dude. Yeah,
sell some shit coins and invest in your future.
No, man, I can't sell these shit coins, man. They are my future, you know? Once they go 10,000x... I'll be able to buy like six mics.
We need to talk. We need to have the talk if that's the case. But you know, the market's been good. You know, it's good to see some positivity around. You know, it's been a couple of months now. Bitcoin on somewhat of a tear, nice and steady. The last week aside, which is kind of expected and fairly easy to predict. But yeah, I'm really excited. There's a lot of activity, general activity in the market. Yields are up. Stablecoin flows are up. A bunch of new L2s and L1s launching, airdrops. There's a lot of reasons to be positive. Aside from the price action, you know, just a lot of activity and a lot of things to do. So I've been really busy. Just had a kid in December, and
congratulations.
A couple of weeks off. Thank you. But yeah, so a lot of work to do. You know, a lot of these, you know, L2s require research to understand. You know, some of the L1s that are really interesting are you know, somewhat technically complicated for someone like me. So there's a lot to do, and the macro world's interesting as fuck as well. So I'm really looking forward to 2024. I think that there is going to be fireworks, and when there's fireworks, there's opportunity to make money. Let's get into it, man.
Yeah, man. So I wanted to point out, like, yeah, it does kind of feel like you're saying spring is almost coming early to the crypto markets, and that activity is all a flutter, dude. There's so many things going on at once. It is a refreshing change. Now, you know, you're what I consider my macro expert, Drakon. So I want to know kind of when you felt like the macro situation kind of pivoted. Do you think they landed the soft landing? Is that kind of why you think things are maybe ticking up in the economy here? I want to this is my awkward way of segueing into, tell me about macro, dude.
Yeah, so macro is a very fluid game. You know, you have so much high frequency data that comes in on a daily basis, and it can all, depending on which of that data you look like, you can paint yourself a picture that can be diametrically opposed to a picture someone else could paint using real data as well. So it's kind of a very interesting space where you can pick and choose what's important to you to build out your narrative. And this is based in fact. It's not just coming up with whatever you like. So the issue with 2020 is that a lot of the economic data was predicted to be really bad. And it was predicted to be really bad because interest rates got to double digits. Inflation got to double digits. which resulted in interest rates rising at the fastest pace in a really long time. Generally, when that happens, some things in the economy break. Mm-hmm. Now, the caveat there is that when we say generally when that happens, we mean in the past, that's what's happened. So what changed? You know, what has changed over the last 12, 13, 14 years? What's changed since the GFC is the ability and the desire and the propensity for governments around the world to patch over problems using stimulus and using accommodative monetary policy has been on a different level than previously. So guys like me that like to look at facts and figures and history and try and find pieces of the puzzle, you know, a lot of my friends have made the mistake of, well, you know, when this happens, that happens, and when that happens, this has to happen, because that's what's happened for the last 500 years. The difference being that back then, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, the governments were not as loose with the purse strings. And, you know, US, you're very cognizant of the debt to GDP situation, very cognizant of how, you know, by any reasonable metric, all governments around the world are effectively, you know, insolvent with the amount of money that they have. So what I got wrong, and I'm happy to be wrong because I change my mind very frequently and I adjust my book every day, is that the economy was supposed to break, right? Markets follow the economy. Markets follow growth of companies, profits of companies. Everything else is a narrative, but on any reasonable time frame, equity markets follow earnings, right? And earnings follows economic conditions. So by any reasonable metric, something should have really gone wrong in 2023. And instead, the S&P 500 is at all-time highs. So the first slide that I've got up here.
Oh, let me throw it up for you.
This is what I just said, everyone kind of knows. If you're macro aware at all and you read headlines, everything was supposed to break in 2023. It hasn't. Interest rates are predicted to go in 2024, but we haven't had a cataclysmic economic breakdown in 2023. And equity markets are doing great. That's the story. Now, this is a very simple illustration here of, the S&P 500 is at all-time highs. Most of you know that if you take out the top seven companies in the S&P 500, you end up with the other 493 companies, the constituents of the S&P 500, being around flat, up 3-4% in 2023. So that's an easy, you know, something that's been well documented. What hasn't been as well documented is what's going on with the Russell 2000. So the Russell 2000 comprises 2,000 companies, not 500 companies. And it also isn't a market cap weighted index. It's an equal weighted index. So what that means is in the S&P, the larger a company gets, it comprises a higher weighting in the S&P 500. So it's a market cap weight. S&P, the Russell 2000 is not that. It's just 2,000 companies. Now, what this chart shows is net income growth. Net income is profits. And this is a year-on-year number. And you can see that for four consecutive quarters,
we're profits, bleeding.
Well, down 20%, down 30%, isn't bleeding. That is a catastrophic destruction of earnings in the broader equity market, which again is a reflection of the broader economy. So if you were in the top seven stocks in the S&P 500, you did great. But if you were in anything else, you haven't done so well. Now, so back to your original question around, you know, has there been a soft landing or hasn't there been a soft landing? It doesn't matter. All that matters is the economic data
is not uniformly great.
Okay. Right?
There are certain sections that look good, and there are certain sections that look horrible.
Yeah.
You're going to say something.
No. So what I'm getting from this is soft. It's all been political speech anyway. Soft landing, hard landing, all this stuff. There was pain going to be happening in the economy somewhere. And what seems like has happened is that pain has been felt. It's been expressed, like we've seen. There has been suffering economically, just not in the places that people are generally looking, or at least where our attention is being kind of focused. Is that kind of what I'm getting here? If you're not in the top seven companies, you're not. And that kind of seems to be a greater trend. This is kind of maybe a little off topic, but just a greater trend towards like consolidation, right? The bigger companies keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and you got the smaller companies kind of falling off. Maybe introducing some more outsiders.
It's also a sector. There's also, you know, a sector discussion to be had.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, those seven companies, you know, are tech companies. You know, Tesla is in there, but that's kind of an anomaly. I like to refer to Elon Musk as an anomaly now. That is
he's untrackable, man.
He's an anomaly. And if you're competing with him, then you should probably stop and go and do something else. But if you remove Tesla from the equation, which is a very kind of battleground type topic, but you've got tech companies. You've got tech companies that operate at scale. They're very mature. They have a number of different business lines. And that is not the real economy. It's a big part of it. Mm-hmm. But you're talking about manufacturing. You're talking about retail. Okay. You're talking about, so many different industries that are not that. And all of those companies are really struggling from an earnings perspective. And why are their earnings down? Well, their earnings are down very simply because costs are up, right? Labor is more expensive, mm-hmm. raw materials, all of the inputs that goes into producing a widget or serving a burger or providing a massage, all of that has gone up on account mm-hmm. of inflation. Sure, inflation is somewhat under control, you know, hovering around 3-3.5%. That is not a terrible number to be at, but it is still high, right? You know, that prices increase, 3-3.5% a year, that is something that is very difficult to keep up with. Now, it's not catastrophic and there are levers you can pull. But if you just go to the second slide, it just shows you the IWM, which is the ETF that tracks the Russell 2000. I put it back to COVID just so that we can, you know, get a zoomed out version of it. And if you just have a look, it's at the same level today as it was at the beginning of 2022, right? So you've got 24 months of bananas, right?
Yeah.
Zero.
Chop.
Soft landing, economic data is great. Okay, but you know, if just kind of go a level deeper and try and understand what's actually mm-hmm. happening. Now, this doesn't mean I'm bullish or I'm bearish or anything. We're just talking about what has occurred,
mm-hmm.
right? There's been an earnings destruction in the economy as a whole and across these 2,000 companies. Now, you extrapolate that down to, you know, your corner deli, to, you know, your local cinema, to, you know, where you go buy your shoes. You know, any other small, medium, large business in the economy is probably feeling the same things, because most businesses do not have pricing power, Corbel. So what that means is, you know, if I'm selling you a burger and I'm in New York City and my burger is good, but it's not the best burger you've ever had, but it's good, right? And I'm charging you $20 and my inputs go up 50% over a 2-year period. Right, the price of beef, my rent, electricity, my labor, and I have to put my price for that burger up to $30, right?
Not
and
happening.
I'm in New York City, and there's a burger place on every corner, right? So someone is going to lose out, and you know, some people can have some pricing power, but most of these businesses do not, unless you have something unique, unless you're a Michelin star restaurant. Unless you're Gucci, right? Unless you're the Waldorf Astoria, unless you have a value proposition that is, you know, that gives you that pricing power, you're kind of screwed. And what's interesting about the constituents of the seven top companies, the S&P 500, you know, a lot of businesses rely on Facebook as their marketing arm, right?
Yeah.
Rely on Google as their marketing arm. Rely on Azure and AWS to power their apps and to power their digital infrastructure. These companies have pricing power. There's competition. They're not monopolies. But if they all raise their prices at the same time, you're kind of shit out of luck. So
yeah.
This is just to illustrate that despite the headlines, if we take the Russell 2000 as a more accurate reflection of the US economy, then we're kind of flat over a 2-year period. So there's that. Now, let's talk about why. Get going.
I was just going to co-sign there. I was going to say that seems to be a more acceptable story for kind of, I imagine, how a lot of people are feeling about 2023. I didn't see a lot of people really killing it in 2023 or completely going bust in terms of like their life trajectory. No one got big fat raises, big promotions or anything in 2023. It all seemed to be kind of flat overall.
Well, you know, a lot of people lost their jobs,
mm-hmm.
right? A lot of large public companies got very bloated over the last 3 or 4 years, especially post-COVID. A lot of money was spent and a lot of those headcounts had to come down. You know, famously, Musk buys Twitter, 7,500 employees. I think he got it down to 1,500 literally overnight. Shit runs fine, right? Yeah. So that's just, you know, one anecdote into how bloated a lot of these companies are. So a lot of people lost their jobs and you see these, you know, Meta cut, everybody cut jobs. So,
yeah.
You know, on aggregate, it's flat. But if you're, you know, a junior analyst at a hedge fund or, you know, a mid-level programmer at Google or at Facebook and you lost your job, 2023 fucking sucked.
Yeah.
Because you modeled your life on that situation and now that situation is gone. You can't go and work at a smaller company and get that kind of salary. So what do you have to do? Downsize your house, move to another city. Like for some people, it's been extremely painful. And you're kind of right. There's very few people that kind of hit it out of the park. On aggregate, you would say most people's lives either, you know, were basically in survival mode, which isn't a bad place to be after a period of excess. But as it relates to the market, you know, it certainly... You know, the last 2 months of the year aside, it was a tough market, a very tough market to trade. So let's talk about, you know, so soft landing, blah, 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 blah. Some of the economic data has been good. For example, labor has surprised everyone in terms of how resilient it's been, even with the well-publicized layoffs. And the housing market has also been... you know, fairly strong. So there are certain things that are inconsistent with what you would expect to happen. So slide number three here is my attempt at explaining why some of the, job numbers have been stronger than expected. And by the way, we spoke about this, I think, several months ago, that the government fudges the numbers in a way that is very cheeky. Like if you look at the Chinese numbers, they just fudge the numbers and you can't do shit about it. In the US, you know, there are ways to kind of confirm if something happened or not. So what they do with the non-farm payroll numbers is they give you the announcement and then the next month they are allowed to revise the announcement, right? And I think what's happened is 12 out of the last 13 months, the revision has always been lower than the headline number, right? So this is a recurring theme. I didn't put in the slides because we've talked about it before. So in addition to doing that, the job market isn't as strong as the headlines will let you believe, but it's strong. It surprised everybody. Now, what the US government has been doing is buying jobs. You can do that if you're the government. You can expand government spending in the public sector, pay people more money, and hire more people. That goes in to the job numbers. So 2020 increase in nominal GDP, increase in deficit, increase in nominal debt.
Here we go. Right?
So the bottom part is the one that's important. The government contribution, right, to the change in GDP, right?
Wow.
And you normally want to see it be flat, right? The government shouldn't be, you know, contributing to GDP in a disproportionate amount. In 2023, government spending contributed to almost a third of GDP growth. That's a large fucking number, right? Yeah. You know, outside of, you know, recovering from World War II and like outside of, you know, some really terrible years in history, this doesn't happen. So what they've done is that, and there's another slide here, okay, is they've basically spent money, right, and expanded the government sector. This is aggregate government sector salary and wage growth. Look at that, right? You know, if you go in the real economy and ask a waitress, right, or a bus driver, or anyone else in the real economy, you know, has their wage growth doubled in the last 12 months. No one,
Jesus,
like, that hasn't happened for anybody, but it's happened for government employees. So there are a number of ways that governments can juice the numbers. And this is what the US government has been doing. And you can see it, you know, they've been spending money to prop up the labor market. But here's the kicker.
Wow.
A lot of this money isn't really going into the real economy. It's going to the public sector, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sure, that, you know, public sector employees eat at restaurants and they buy cars and they go on holidays and, you know, all of that stuff. But I don't think anyone in the US, if they saw this chart, would feel good that while they have to, you know, adjust their lifestyle to fit in with the current environment, I don't think they're going to feel good when they realize that the government's been spending a shit ton of money that's going into the pocket of government employees.
Yeah. Well, I think the big question here is what government employment is being expanded? Is this just like bureaucratic expansion? Because from my understanding, historically, right, governments do is like typical, like you were saying, government intervention in the economy in terms of like, trying to fluff up numbers or to direct monetary policy. It's not uncommon for a government to essentially, for example, expand like public works projects, right? Very classic example. We're going to hire, I think Teddy Roosevelt did it. We're going to hire like 100,000 Boy Scouts and they're going to build national parks or whatever. Decent way to get jobs going in a down way. You're expanding infrastructure. But I haven't seen any massive infrastructure expansions in America. Who really knows where this money's going?
So, yeah. So Corbell, right? Mm-hmm. The current chart we have in front of us is not government spending. It's aggregate government sector salary and wage growth. These are not infrastructure
projects.
Just
raises.
Right? This is not building bridges. This is individuals just being hired or being paid more. Right.
Wow.
And, you know, I don't really need to double click on that and try and work out where it's not the business I'm in. I'm just trying to work out if the labor market is as hot as the headline number suggests.
Yeah.
And why this is important. Why this is important is that, you know, the Biden administration is, you know, has. Someone just put a comment in there about the 80,000 IRS agents.
Oh yeah,
I don't think that happened. I think someone was able, you know, in Congress or at some point they were able to put a pause on that or put a stop on it. But you know, there are a lot of things that have happened that just don't show up in the headlines, right? The federal government has so much, like, you know, try and find data on, you know, the hiring practices of the FBI or the NSA or, you know, any of these government departments. I mean, I don't know how accurate or, you know, how forthcoming that'll all be, but it does show up in the aggregate numbers. So when you have an administration that is pro-regulation, mm-hmm. that is coming up for re-election, that is pretty unpopular, you know, no one would dispute that Biden is unpopular right now, regardless of which side of the aisle you sit on. You know, mm-hmm. you need to work out how you're going to, you know, sway people to vote your way. And, you know, both parties do it. This isn't, you know, me hating on the Dems or anything, but you try to spread some money around. And you don't spend the money around 2 months before the election when everyone's looking. You spread it out 18 months before the election when no one's looking. And so, you know, it's not a conspiracy theory. Everyone does this. But this is, you know, a lot of money being pumped into the economy. Because if you go back to the previous slide, so the increase in nominal GDP, you know, that number there is 1202. Mm-hmm. Look at the increase in the deficit.
Still right? sinking, so dude.
So the entire deficit is the increase mm-hmm. in nominal GDP. So the Biden administration has basically pumped money into the economy, right? They've borrowed money, they've bought some jobs, and they've tried to kind of, you know, massage the figures to manufacture what some might call a soft landing. Here's the kicker, right? Mm-hmm. This doesn't last forever. Not because they run out of money, right? Just because at some point push comes to shove, right? When you have earnings on the Russell 2000 down 25-30%, I think it was 34%, right? On the last bar there, which is, you know, Q3 of 23.
Yeah.
This all gets felt into the economy on a lag, right? That's fewer, you know, less money in people's pockets. That's restaurants closing. That's all of these things. So what I think has happened is the can has been kicked down the road. I think a recession is going to happen in 2024. The Biden administration is going to do their best to kind of patch it up. And that's why you're seeing talk about rate cuts. And that's why you're seeing things like student loan forgiveness. Over the last couple of days, I'm sure you saw the headlines.
Oh yeah.
All of these things are you know, kind of, you know, just covering up the cracks. Yeah.
But yeah.
The boat's still sinking, and I don't mean sinking in that, you know, the US goes bust or something. What I mean is that there will be a reckoning, and the reckoning is going to come in a variety of different formats. So. I'm very cautious equities 2024, especially at current valuations. I think that the predictions of multiple rate cuts, I think it was like 4 or 5 in 2024, are just fucking bonkers. I just don't think that happens. You can already see chatter that the market is probably set. It was an 80% probability that there would be a cut in March. That's down to 50 now, right?
Yeah.
So it didn't take long for people to get the, you know, to kind of get the sense slapped into them that, you know, you're not just going to go up to 5.5% and then back down to 2% in a matter of 24 months. Like, that's just not going to happen. So
that's what people would like to see. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. What?
No, yeah. So that's what people would like to happen, but it's just not going to happen. I have a lot of reasons to be bullish crypto, and we'll get to that on the last slide. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons, you know, on my negative catalyst is just that expectations around rate cuts in 2024 are just way too hot. So a disappointment on the, you know, the rollout of rate cuts is going to hurt the markets. I'm not smart enough to predict when they happen and when they don't happen. I just look at the information that comes in every day and I adjust my probabilities, you know, accordingly.
Am I wrong, Nick, by assuming that, so rate cuts become much more likely if a recession does hit hard though, right? Especially like
correct.
In an election.
That's why markets are at all time high.
Yeah, that could be a catalyst for a massive amount of rate cuts rapidly if they start panicking, like the shit's hitting the fan. We need to pull out the money printer.
Yeah. So you're right. We live in a world where bad news is good news for the markets, because we live in a world where for 15 years, markets have not been allowed to go down. Right? This is just not how it's been done for the entirety of history outside of the last 15 years. Usually when you get a recession, there is some pain. Companies go bankrupt. People go bankrupt. Businesses close. And there is somewhat of a reset as that leverage and all of that accumulated, you know, bad economic effects need to be flushed out. But what's happened over the last 15 years is whenever there's an inkling that that's going to happen, the government comes in and starts spraying money. So the reason the S&P 500 is at an all-time high right now is everyone else is realizing that there will be a recession in 2024. It's now the consensus view. And as a result, the view is that in an election year with, you know, a trigger-happy administration, that they're just going to start airdropping money to everyone. I don't think that's a crazy view to hold, right? What we don't know is the timing of it, the quantum of it. There are some interesting dynamics where, you know, you don't really know what's going to happen with Biden. I bet a lot of money this week that Biden isn't the next president. I didn't bet on Trump winning or something. I just bet that he isn't the next president.
Yeah. Well, what are the odds on that? I'm going to get in on that. I feel like they got to be pretty good that he's not.
Pretty well, it pays out about $1.58, right? Okay. So 10 grand gets you like almost 16 grand. So I think it's a stupidly good value bet. Because A, Trump, I think, beats him almost always if it's them two. And it looks like Trump is going to be the nominee. And I also think there is a increasing probability that the Dems pull him, because his polling data just doesn't get any better against Trump. You've got hardcore Democrats that, you know, are coming out and saying, look, Trump was right about this and right about that and right about this and right about that. And Biden doesn't know what day it is. So what are we doing?
Yeah.
So anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that if Biden gets pulled, right, and the Dems go into panic mode, they've got very few levers that they can pull. But one of them is, you know, a ton of spending, an absolute shit ton of spending outside of rate cuts. So I think the risk is whether Biden stays or goes or anything like that, the Dems are under so much pressure that I've always been I'm usually bearish. I think reasonable people take over, right? When push comes to shove, and the money printer doesn't just go on irresponsibly. I think my view's changed. I think we live in a world right now where the clown shoes are out, and you know, they're just going to keep blowing out this deficit. Which for me is the core bull case for Bitcoin. I see no way that Bitcoin is lower a year from now than it is today, just because so much more money is going to be put into the system, whether it's a recession, right? Whether it's the Dems panicking and trying to, you know, buy votes the way that every administration would do. All of this leads to one thing, the debasement of the dollar. So that's good for Bitcoin.
Yeah. No, that makes perfect sense. The trend will just continue of the debasement of the dollar. Are you ready for slide 6? It sounds like that's like one of the catalysts, man. Yeah.
Let's look at 5 first.
Oh, sorry.
you know, so again, 80% probability like a few weeks ago that there'll be a rate cut in March. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, well, now maybe not, right? So I expect more of that. I expect that the rate cut, aggressive rate cut story is going to be diluted greatly over the coming weeks. But I'm fully ready for what happens if they start to cut early. But now we can go to slide six.
All right. Yeah.
So, you know, we're in the crypto space.
Sure are.
And all of this needs to tie back to something. As you can see, I've got a lot more positive catalysts than negative catalysts. Naturally, the short-term volatility we're seeing in the crypto markets has a lot to do with a supply flush out that's related to GBTC. I think most people are wrong that, you know, 20% of the AUM will leave GBTC, 25%. Like, I was trying to place a bet, talking to Polymarkets for them to put up a market. Mm. I think GBTC is going to lose upwards of 50% of its AUM this year.
Is that just because of their insane fee? Isn't it like...
All right. So let's break it down. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's break it down. You've got, you know, what is it? 9, 10 different ETFs, all mm-hmm. from, you know, top tier financial firms. You know, very, very similar in terms of their offering, the trust component, like, you know, do you trust Fidelity more than BlackRock? Like, these, you know, for me, the trust is all the same.
Yeah.
So how do you compete? You know, how do you compare these things? You've got one thing, fee. So you've got a variety of fees there, but let's call the aggregate fee, you know, 25, 30, right? And some of them have a honeymoon period where you pay zero, and there's some really good deals out there. But let's say the base fee is 25 basis points. Now, Grayscale's got it at 150 basis points, okay? And the idea that someone would pay 150 instead of 25, assuming that you trust BlackRock and Fidelity and all of these other, you know, and Galaxy yeah. and all of these other companies, at the same level that you trust Grayscale, mm-hmm. assuming, you know, you're that stupid, then why would you pay the 150? Well, this is the case for it, that a lot of those holdings are sitting on very large capital gains. Mm-hmm. And by selling, you know, redeeming from GBTC, that you trigger a tax event in order to roll it into the new fund, right? So Barry's very, very smart by putting a 1.5% fee on there, knowing that he has a lot of capital that's trapped. Mm. And I use the word trap loosely because they're not trapped. They can leave whenever they want, but there's some calculus that you can do if you're one of those holders and say, well, you know, if I exit this position and then roll it into a BlackRock or Fidelity or something else, I'm going to pay, you know, 25% in cap gains or whatever the number happens to be. And that's like, you know, 11 years of fees to Barry. So what am I going to do? Okay. So that's the case. That's why people think a lot of that capital is not going to flow out.
That makes sense. But, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, a lot of, and I'm just assuming here, I don't have any data to pull it up. But if you think about the entire 23, 24 billion of AUM that, you know, they have, or when you start, I think it's down to 20 now, right? And you think about the life cycle of that AUM, right? How much of that has bought in 2013, okay, and hasn't sold any of it until today, mm-hmm. right? You know, how much of it has just stayed there? How much of it has been buying and selling during the, you know, the peaks and troughs, mm-hmm. right? How many people were selling it at a premium, right? You know, selling their GBTC at a premium and then use that money to go buy spot at Coinbase, right? So there's yeah. been a lot of market movement since 2013 when they were the only game in town until 2020, 2021, 2022 when, you know, if you were sitting on 100 million or 50 million, if you're one of these, you know, OG whales, you know, you had ample opportunity to work this shit out, right? And you know, maybe take a cap gain, maybe sell, right, in 21 when the and all your other shit lost money, You could sell that, offset your capital. So I think the point I'm trying to make is, I don't think a very large percentage of the GBTC is trapped using that thesis. Huh. So I think the outflows are going to be much, much larger. I think most of that is probably going to go buy another ETF, mm-hmm. right? So I don't think it's going to be that detrimental to Bitcoin itself. But you know, if someone wants to take the other side of that bet, I would bet a large amount that it's over 50% given a 12-month period. So anyway, that's a short-term kind of supply flush out. You know, you've got Mt. Gox. It's not a large number. Mm-hmm. I think it's a couple hundred thousand of Bitcoin. Do you know how much it is?
Yeah, if I remember, it's significant, but not that significant. Let's see.
It's a few billion dollars.
850,000 Bitcoin, now valued at $33
billion. No, that...
No, I think that's the total. I don't think that's what's actually coming out, though. So yeah, 20%.
I think that's what was lost.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's a couple hundred thousand that's going to be distributed. You'll get some selling pressure there. You know, the FTX estate has been selling, you know, so we don't know when that ends or anything like that. So you've got a short-term supply flush out. That's fine. No problem. And again, rate cut disappointment will affect all markets. You know, if equities get hit, I expect crypto to get hit. I'm encouraged that there is some divergence in how the crypto market's been behaving and the equity market's been behaving. That's how it should be, in my opinion, mm-hmm. especially as it relates to Bitcoin, which is not a business. It is not Amazon. It should trade on a different set of fundamentals. So I'm encouraged to see a little bit of that. But rate cut disappointment is going to affect the bull case. Now, positive catalysts. Mm-hmm. I actually have to go in like 5 minutes, but we'll get through this.
Let's do it.
Increased government spending in an election year. As we can see, they've been doing it in 2023. That's what's kept things rosy. We all expect a lot more of that. That's good for Bitcoin. And because it's good for Bitcoin, it probably means there's more liquidity for people to degen it up, chase their airdrops, and gamble it up with perps and buy their NFTs. So this is all positive for markets in general. I think there will be further judicial slip-ups for the SEC, which by all accounts is a complete clown show right now, whether it's, you know, 2FA or losing every court case that they engage in. Like, they once were a very formidable adversary, right? You wouldn't win. If they went after you, unless you're Mark Cuban, you lost. Fact. This is not that organization, right? They are an absolute mess. So I expect them to get slapped around during the year in all of the different cases that they have before the courts. I think if Biden, the longer they keep Biden in, the likelihood that that Trump wins in November goes up. I think that's good for markets if Trump wins. Mm-hmm. So the longer they keep Biden in, the better it's for markets in 2025. Now, if you know, Biden withdraws, which I think everyone agrees he should, and they put up a somewhat, you know, center-leaning Democrat who is reasonable, relatively young, somewhat likable, then, you know, I think no one really wants another 4 years of Trump, but mm-hmm. everyone agrees that another 4 years of Biden is not, no one wants that either. So I think if the Dems can put up someone reasonable against Trump, then they have a really good shot of regaining the White House, of keeping the White House, sorry. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, is probably bad for crypto. In general, because of the general hostile stance that you know, this administration and its apparatus, whether it's Senator Warren or the SEC, has against crypto. So again, Biden not running, not the longer he hangs around, mm-hmm. the more bullish Raycon's going to get, because I just think Trump's going to wipe the floor with it. You know. But so let's move on. Mm-hmm. Steady and increasing net inflows into the BTC ETFs, right? when they launched, I put a few tweets out and I said, look, all your expectations are completely out of whack, right? These are very large organizations with very large sales teams, and they're not going to be able to get all of their clients on the phone on day one to sell them this thing, right? This Salesforce has been trained to sell a particular set of products. BTC is somewhat different. There's some explaining to do. There is an education life cycle. So give these sales forces, which are vast and experienced, right? Give them some time to be able to get to their clients and tell the story. So that is not a one quarter or a two quarter story, right? This is going to kind of roll out over time. So what you want to see is a steady and increasing flow of money going into these ETFs. We all expect it. And the trajectory of that, for these huge spikes, right? You're looking for steady and increasing, because what that tells you is the sales forces are getting through to their clients. And once they get through to 10% or 20% of their clients, these people talk to each other, right? And now people that hold a BTC ETF, a particular institution, a particular family office, a particular family, you know, now can explain it to everybody else. So what happens is you get this flow-on effect that that kind of picks up steam. So 6 months from now, if you just chart the ETF AUM and it's kind of not a hockey stick, but a very linear progression, that's extremely bullish to me, because it means that the BlackRocks, the Fidelities, the ARCs are getting through to their clients that traditionally would not have been allocated into Bitcoin. And that's what interests us, right? It's not money from GBTC rolling over somewhere else. Yeah, it's not Corval selling his and buying the ETF. We're talking about new inflows from new market participants that have not allocated to crypto in a meaningful way previously, because that's the bull case on the ETFs. It's that it would allow people that would otherwise have not been interested to now be able to hold the asset. So that's what I'm looking for. I don't care what it does in January. I don't care what it does in February. I'm going to be zooming out, looking at monthly figures and aggregate figures. I don't care where the money goes in terms of which ETF. I'm just looking at more people putting money into the ETF this month than they were last month. Obviously, the ETH ETF approval is bullish. I don't share the view of most of crypto Twitter that it will be approved at the first available opportunity. Yeah. You're still dealing with a hostile SEC. And Commissioner Hester Price was, you know, interviewed yesterday and says, you know, we learned a lot. The ETH ETF is not going to go through the scrutiny that the BTC ETF went through. We look like idiots. We don't want to look like idiots. That's her view. She's been maintaining that throughout the entirety of the BTC ETF saga. She's an ally, right? Mm-hmm. The rest of the commission are adversaries. They're not going to change their tune. So I expect the ETH ETF to be fought, you know, as hard as the BTC ETF, and it will drag on and on and on until they end up in court again and will lose again, and then it will be approved. So if I think consensus is, you know, May or June, that's when it kind of comes up. Well, I don't think that'll happen for the reasons I've outlined, but I think it will happen. And when it does happen, that is obviously bullish. I don't think there's a scenario where it doesn't get approved. It's going to go to court, right? The playbook is very clear now that the judicial system is functioning as it should, and that if you challenge the SEC and you're right, you have a very good chance of the courts ruling in your favor. Now, that doesn't mean the SEC is going to stop challenging all this stuff. They're going to go to court and they're going to get slapped every time. So the last two, further geopolitical instability and the expansion of wars around the world, especially as it relates to Bitcoin, instability, dislocation of businesses, dislocation of people, people kind of getting nervous, sanctions, right? Yeah. Like if you're an Iranian businessman right now and you've got nothing to do with geopolitical risk and, you know, you're running the Burger King in Iran and, like, you know, you're very restricted with how you can invest around the world, right? So these kind of events around the world, you know, what's happening in Israel and Gaza, you know, I'm in Cyprus, we're like a 30-minute flight from Israel, you know, a lot of Israelis have have come to Cyprus. They're buying up property. You know, I know a few developers. I know a few car dealers. They're buying this shit in Bitcoin, mm-hmm. right? Stable coins, because it's very easy for them to move their capital, you know, and move to a new jurisdiction and get set up like this, right? So the more of these kind of destabilizing events take place around the world, then you know, Bitcoin be, you know, Bitcoin and crypto in general be a method of you know, a real use case for moving your money around and being able to escape these things. Tangential to this mm-hmm. is, you know, there is a I'm never able to pronounce it, so I'm just going to look it up. But so wow. it has to do with China.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a waterway called the Malacca Strait, mm-hmm. right? And it is extremely important in getting goods in and out of China. In the event that China shows any aggression to Taiwan, the war games that everyone is aware of is that the US and its allies are going to block the Malacca Strait, basically choking off a bunch of supply and economic activity into China. This is not a secret, not a conspiracy theory. This is the if-then-what kind of situation.
The war plan.
Knows this. It is the war plan, right? China knows this because they're not idiots. So what they've been doing for a really long time is building up their stockpiles, their reserves of crucial commodities, oil, food, etc. So they know that while they rely on the Malacca Strait to function, then, you know, the rest of the world has, the US has some leverage on them. They know that if they can reach a certain point of inventory and stockpile of these crucial commodities and elements, then they reach a point where they have 5 years worth of, you know, fuel in the tank, if you like, and then they can, then that pawn on the chess piece is removed. They're like, block it. We don't care. We're good. So that number of barrels of oil is 1.4 billion barrels of oil in reserves, okay? Mm-hmm. That's the number that they need to be able to not be concerned about the Malacca Strait. In, you know, and I don't know about what's happening behind closed doors, but this is kind of common knowledge. So they've been increasing their stockpiles. They're at about a billion now. So what people look for is an uptick in that. The closer mm-hmm. that number gets to 1.4 billion, the likelihood, the probability that you start to see some instability in the Red China Sea goes up, because China will, you know, have a lot less things to worry about.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, you know, tangential to further geopolitical stability. And it's very difficult to know, because they're very smart and they're probably, you know, smuggling this stuff in and they're hiding it underground. And there's a shit ton of stuff you do. So, but generally speaking, you would expect further geopolitical instability in 2024 as some of these things start to fester. And you already see what's happening in the Red Sea with, you know, the attacks on merchant vessels. You've got a bunch of the world's freight is now 30-40% more expensive as these vessels need to go around the Horn of Africa. It's very well publicized. Mm-hmm. So now you've got inflation fears too, because these things, you know, it represents so much trade that it cannot be ignored. But we'll put it all under further geopolitical instability. And the last positive catalyst is, you know, increased DeFi activity in a competitive landscape. It leads to a lot more liquidity in the system. What do I mean by that, right? So L1's launching, L2's launching, new protocols launching, VC money that's been, you know, starting to pipe through. A lot more activity means there is a lot more money to be spent by these chains and by these protocols. That money ends up in Corbin's pocket. He gets an airdrop. Now he's got more money to go shitcoining or to buy NFTs or to yield, you know, to yield farm. So I think 2024 is going to see an expansion of activity as we've already seen, that with that expansion of activity, you see increased competition for the finite TVL, the finite users, and then you see a bunch of liquidity pumped into the ecosystem using the VC dollars or dollars that are just completely, you know, printed out of thin air in the in these tokens. But it all means that DeFi participants have more money in their pockets. And that has to be bullish for at least the alt sector anyway. Maybe it's bullish for ETH and BTC as well. So a kind of a pause there.
Yeah, no, I mean, fantastic, Dracon. I mean, it's definitely bullish for DeFi participants like me. More money flowing into my pockets from VCs. But yeah, thank you, man. I think that was a really fascinating presentation, Dracon. It was always a pleasure to pick your mind. And conscientious of your time here, I see where they were over. So I'll let you go. I know you got another meeting to hop to. I want to thank you so much, Nick, for coming on. This is a great show, man. Really informative. Cool. Yeah, we got to do this again, dude.
Yeah. Yeah, let's do a bit more often. I got to go because I've got another meeting, but thanks for having me on. Hopefully I wasn't just too all over the place. I tried to keep it on point. But in summary, bullish crypto over the year, irrespective of what happens in the short term, you're going to see, you know, these, you know, Bitcoin's going to drop 5K in a matter of a week multiple times during the year. Don't use leverage, excessive leverage, and just try to stay in the game. If you stay in the game and you don't do stupid shit, you should make a ton of money in 2024. If you're in crypto. Right.
Time in the market more than time in the market. All right, guys. Thanks so much for watching. And we'll see you next time. We'll see you tomorrow with Beebus, I believe. So take care, folks.